Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on geopolitics in Asia. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
So in today's podcast, we'll be doing something a little unusual in that we'll be devoting most of our time and energy to discussing events actually occurring outside of the Asia-Pacific region. Specifically, we'll be discussing the ongoing territorial disintegration of Iraq. Territorial disintegration might be a little bit dramatic, but we'll be discussing the situation there with the radical advances being made by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, a radical Sunni group that's essentially taken over a large part of Iraqi territory from the government following an offensive that began on June 10th. We'll be devoting most of our time to discussing ISIL's advances in Iraq, and we'll also talk about what impact this has for Asia's powers, particularly India and China, which are both watching the situation with some interest. So I'll just go very briefly and just do a timeline of ISIS's campaign in Iraq, as a lot has happened in the past week, and these have some particularly deep consequences for the government in Baghdad and for the United States and Asian powers in the region. So on June 10th, hundreds of jihadi fighters led by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, essentially took Mosul, which is a city in northern Iraq, just on the border of the Sunni heavy areas and the Kurdish heavy areas. And essentially, after they took Mosul, this issue kind of rose to the top of mainstream media in the United States and across the world, as this was something a lot of people weren't really expecting, given that ISIL had mostly focused their efforts on the war in Syria against Bashar al-Assad's government. And there were a lot of reports on June 10th that two divisions of Iraqi soldiers simply laid down their arms and ran from fierce ISIL fighters. But since then, we've essentially learned that that wasn't really a product of the ISIL fighters' tactics or their fearsomeness. It was mostly the Iraqi soldiers being unmotivated and uncommitted to the government in Baghdad, essentially. I think, Zach, you can talk about that in more detail later. I know you have some thoughts about that. And then on June 11th, they continued their campaign. They captured Tikrit, which was Saddam Hussein's birthplace in Iraq. And following that, there have been so the Kurdish forces in the north of Iraq essentially responded, and they took Kirkuk on June 12th, which is a major oil hub from the jihadis. And there's still a lot of fighting going on there around Kirkuk between ISIL fighters and Kurdish forces. On June 13th to 15th, around that time, was when the Iranian government became very involved, and a Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani began urging Shiite Iraqis to take up arms against the Sunni militants, essentially turning this into a bit of a sectarian struggle between Iran's Shiites and Sunnis, with the Shiites being backed by Iran, and the Sunnis naturally coming mostly from Syria and from within Iraq. Sponsored by the tribal leaders within that country. And since then, essentially, the situation has been readily advancing towards Baghdad. But however, ISIL has not really made any big advances towards Baghdad. There were reports that the airport was being attacked, but those turned out to be a little bit overblown. So far, the United States has responded by essentially saying that it will not be going back to war in Iraq, but it will be sending 300 military advisors. I believe the first of those ended up actually arriving there today on June 25th. So the situation in Iraq is really dire, and it's starting to get the whole world kind of concerned about the fate of the Middle East again, and it's going to have important ramifications for certainly the Asia-Pacific region, but also the world in more general. So Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about one of the more important actors here, which is Iran? What is Iran's take? I mean, obviously they're not happy that a Sunni militant group has taken over most of Iraq and is threatening to overthrow a Nour al-Maliki's government. But, you know, how do they see this unraveling? What is their strategy here?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I'd caution. I mean, I wouldn't say ISIL has taken northern Iraq, but I wouldn't say taken most of Iraq. I'm not sure really if Iran – I don't think Iranian leaders necessarily see a huge threat to Maliki's government being overthrown. I think they more see the threat in terms of Karubala, which is a Shia – a place with – it's a little north of Baghdad, and it has Shia shrines that ISIL, if it takes a town, is likely to try to destroy. So it's already said that that would be a red line for it. In terms of if ISIL did pose a threat to take over Iraq, Iran would never let this happen. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. I mean, ISIL, even when the U.S. military was in Iraq, ISIL, which at that time was calling itself Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was more focused on killing Sunnis and killing American soldiers. In fact, they had a dispute with Al-Qaeda Central, Bin Laden, and Ayman al-Zawahiri over whether to focus on Shia or whether to focus on U.S. troops. So Iran could just never – most of Iran's threats historically, at least modern history, have come from Iraq. That's like because of geography, that's really the most vulnerable place for Iran. So it would just never, ever allow ISIL militants to take over all of Iraq. In terms of them taking over northern Iraq, this does pose a threat to Iranian interests because this is part of the Shia Crescent, how basically Iran's influence extends from Iraq to Syria, to Lebanon, and even into Palestine. And this is controlling the border region between Iraq and Syria is obviously key for Iran, or not necessarily Iran controlling it, but its allies and proxies. So it can use overland routes to resupply the Syrian effort and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So I think it definitely, I mean, it sees this as a huge threat. It also just sees a general tide of rising sectarian tensions and violence in the Middle East as a huge threat because, you know, Iran's a Persian and Shia state where most of the Middle East is Arab and Sunni. So the more these – so it's always – the Islamic Republic of Iran has always tried to downplay these sectarian conflicts through – I mean, this is like what part of the reason behind Ahmadinejad's like denouncing Israel and Iran in general denouncing Israel. It tries to focus on Israel in opposition to the U.S. to try to – as ways to kind of unite this the Muslim world or the Muslim Middle East together and get overcome these sectarian differences. So – it definitely sees this as a threat. Initially, it indicated it was willing to cooperate with the U.S. in Iraq. Then on Sunday, Supreme Leader Khamenei said that he came out in opposition to the any U.S. military intervention, at least. And they've actually Iran in publicly has kind of tried to portray the whole uprising and fighting in Iraq as like somehow the fault of Israel and the U.S., which, I mean, again, I think it's trying to downplay the sectarian tensions. And I should note, I think, that it's not clear at all that ISIL is really leading this thing. I mean, they've been on, they're certainly part of the mix, but this is a much bigger Sunni uprising against Malaki. At most, ISIL is in the front because the Sunni tribes are really leading the effort. One of the main leaders of one of the main Sunni tribes in Iraq actually kind of had this disparaging comment towards the Americans or towards the international press. He said something effective. This is idiotic to say that this uprising is ISIL. They don't have enough manpower or vehicles to possibly cause all this ruckus. Like, this is like, you know, it's not even logical to say this. I mean, 800 people cannot take over Mosul and stuff. So I think it's key to note this is a sectarian conflict. Iran wants to certainly keep control over Iraq, but also at least the part of Iraq where it borders it, which is a Shia part. But it also wants to downplay the sectarian tensions and try to maintain control over the border. So I actually expect it to kind of push for a reconciliation between the different factions in Iraq, kind of like the U.S. is doing.
Yeah, I mean, one of ISIL's main goal with this entire campaign in Iraq is essentially to abolish the post-colonial borders of Sikhs Picot and essentially establish national identities in the Middle East that are governed by borders that are actually, you know, that actually have to do with the sects that are occupying these areas. So for Iraq, that means essentially demarcating a Kurdish area, a Sunni Muslim area, and then a Shiite area, which is significantly smaller towards the south of the country. Do you think? I mean, so we'll talk a bit about the United States in a second, which obviously, you know, has a completely different vision for Iraq, mostly informed by its own campaign there in the 2000s. But do you think that Iran would go for a splitting up of Iraq, allowing for a Shiite state to emerge in the south?
I mean, I think as a last resort over the Sunnis retaking Iraq, yes. But, I mean, this isn't Iran's goal because, again, this would cut off Iran's ability to supply Syria and Hezbollah and Lebanon through overland routes. So it really wants it more so than, like, other – even the U.S. and the other states, the Sunni states has an interesting saying – Iraq not disintegrate into different different areas. But I should note, we should note that Iran has pretty strong influence with a lot of the Kurds in Iraq from the days of Saddam Hussein, where, and even the Shahs of Iran kind of used the Kurds to undermine Sunni rule in Iraq. And one of the Kurdish leaders went to Iran last week. So, I mean, Iran has a lot of cards to play here, but I think that, like, to answer your question, no, I don't think Iran, that would only be a last resort for Iran to let Iraq break up. What about your thoughts?
No, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I think we can, you know, segue a bit into the United States' role here in Iraq, which is, you know, John Kerry's right there right now. He sees this as an existential threat to essentially what the United States accomplished or didn't accomplish in Iraq when it pulled out its troops there. I mean, Zach, you wrote a piece about how ISIL's campaign, if it tells us anything definitively, it's that the surge failed in Iraq. And essentially, what we're seeing now is a complete revival of, you know, sectarian infighting. And essentially, Maliki's government has completely failed at attempting to include Iraq's Kurds and Sunnis into this process. I think that the United States is going to has a really big uphill struggle here in getting Iraq to essentially hold together in a way that would be in line with the goals that it was trying to accomplish when it was fighting there. What are your thoughts on the U.S. response?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. I mean, it seems like people, a lot more than I expected, people in the U.S. especially, have kind of just given up on a unified Iraq. I remember on Morning Joe, the MSNBC show the other day, Richard Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Z. Big Brzezinski, former national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, they both were on the show, and they both were like, I don't really see Iraq becoming a unified state again. Which, I mean, if you remember back in, I think it's 2007 or even 2006, Joe Biden and Les Gelb, who's also from the Council of Foreign Relations, put out a piece calling for, like, basically, this is before the surge, to break up Iraq into three distinct areas, and that piece got slammed, everyone. And so, I mean, this is, U.S. has been completely against allowing Iraq to break up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why, though, because, it might, first of all, stabilize the situation, and second of all, it would split Iran's influence. It would cut the Shia crescent in half, so I think the U.S. has a lot stronger interest in having Iraq break up, potentially, than Iran does.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we've talked about this a bit. You know, there's just this aversion to balkanized solutions to multi-ethnic conflicts in Western foreign policy circles in general. And I think that, you know, maybe that resistance is starting to erode a bit once people begin to recognize the reality of the situation on the ground. But it's definitely one of those cognitive biases that I think a lot of policymakers struggle with, particularly with cases like Iraq.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me because, I mean, like, Europe kind of split into these different groups, especially Western Europe, and I mean, that didn't turn out necessarily. I mean, there were these world wars, which are pretty bad. But I mean, like, you know, now Europe's pretty stable. And also just, I think, homogeneous states around the world, from Europe, Western Europe, to Asia, to Latin America even. The more homogeneous a state is, the more likely it seems to be to emerge as, like, a democracy. So, I mean, this aversion towards breaking up this bulk, to breaking up states, I think is, like you said, it's more a cognitive, like, you know, dissidents than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting. You look at, like, the historical precedents about how the Ottoman Empire actually administered, you know, what is today Iraq and Syria, and the level of autonomy they afforded to these independent groups. It seemed like when the Ottoman Empire collapsed in the early 20th century that the logical solution, instead of, you know, Sykes-Picot and the mandates, would have been to allow these nations to essentially emerge from the rubble of the Ottoman Empire, and that didn't happen. So I think what we're seeing now is essentially a longer-term response to a failed colonial borders. And I think it's going to be a big struggle to kind of fight back against that from the perspective of Western policymakers. It's just a huge uphill struggle right now in Iraq.
Yeah, we've discussed, I mean, I see this as part of a much larger historical process that I call the Balkanization of global politics, where, I mean, really since the Ottoman Empire, but especially since World War II, we've just seen instead of states growing bigger, as has been the historical trend, we've just seen states fragmenting constantly. And, you know, there was 50 states at the beginning of the 20th century, and then, like, close to 200 by the end of it, which is just exponential growth. I mean, some of this was decolonialization, some of it was the breakup of the Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, India and Pakistan, West Pakistan, East Pakistan, Indonesia and East Timor. I mean, we've seen this. This is an ongoing process. It's not just the Middle East.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think we should maybe talk about that during different podcasts. I think that'd be a very interesting topic.
Yeah,
I mean, Zach, you know, just before we move on to talking about Asian powers' responses to Iraq, I just wanted to kind of, you know, we both kind of wrote about the possibility for the United States to work with Iran a bit. You had a piece in the National Interest. Why don't you tell us a bit about, you know, the reasons that that makes good sense for the U.S. at this point, working with Iran?
Well, I think as we kind of hinted at this whole time, there's a lot of shared interests in terms of first propping up the Maliki government, second destroying ISIL or beating it back as much as possible because they both see it as a threat, and then maintaining a unified Iraq. So I think in the near term, at least, in the piece in the National Interest, I actually argue that the U.S. should just let Iran deal with propping up the Maliki government, and then the U.S. should position itself to sort of act as a neutral power broker between the different factions in Iraq and Iran and Turkey and maybe some other regional powers. So I just think that the situation isn't as dire as it's first portrayed. It wasn't – the Maliki government's not about to fall. The Shias are never going to – they're going to resist Sunni taking over Baghdad way more than they did northern Iraq. So I thought like letting Iran deal with the Maliki government's probably the best move, and partly also because Iran has a great track record in terms of intervening in the middle of civil wars in the Middle East and shoring up their proxies. I mean, it built Hezbollah in the middle of the Lebanon civil war when it didn't have any prior influence really in Lebanon. It's propped up Assad, of course, and it outmaneuvered the U.S. and Iraq after 2003. So I just said that the U.S. should let Iran save the Maliki government and then use its position as a neutral power broker to kind of secure its interests diplomatically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the U.S. gets too close to Iran, then it really doesn't want to be seen taking sides in a sectarian battle in the Middle East, particularly with allies in the Gulf, and Saudi Arabia especially wouldn't be too happy with that. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. But yeah, especially because it's also supporting the Sunni opposition attempts to overthrow a Shia government in Syria.
In Syria, exactly.
I mean, most people in the region see this as like the same conflict, but the U.S. is going to take completely different opposite positions. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, can't fight on two sides of the same battle.
Yeah, it's just an awful idea.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a very, you know, fast-developing event, so likely a lot of the things we just said on the podcast might even be irrelevant by tonight, but hopefully, you know, keep an eye on The Diplomat. We're actually covering this quite a bit, since it does have important implications for Asian powers. Speaking of whom, let's just briefly talk about this a bit. Let's start talking about China. So China has a major investment presence in Iraq. And, you know, I remember reading a lot of articles after the United States pulled out of Iraq, essentially declaring that China won the Iraq war because as a major oil importer, you know, China relies on 8% of its imports to come from Iraq. So essentially it has huge stakes right now. China is obviously watching this with bated breath, particularly because, you know, it does have its principle of non-interventionism, which essentially leads it to be against any sort of international intervention, be that from Iran, be that from the United States. That has to do with its own, you know, concerns about its own territory and separatist movements within China. But Zach, you know, do you really see China taking any sort of international leadership role in Iraq? I mean, I really don't see that happening here, despite their interests.
No, I had a rant of a piece on this in my blog last week that, I mean, it's like, it's just amazes me basically how detached, it's changed a little bit in recent days, but basically China just stayed completely detached from the situation and acts like it has no interest or responsibility it was completely ignored the situation for like a week and a half. Now it's starting to publish more about it, but I mean, to be fair, China's interests in Iraq are primarily oil, and its oil interests are mostly in the south, so they're not really threatened by the Sunnis taking over the northern Iraq. But I mean, that's just so short-sighted, and it's just, especially in terms of leaning on Maliki to form a reconciliation government or to, you know, bring the Sunni more inclusive government. I mean, China has a ton of influence with Maliki because of its investments in the oil industry.
Yeah. I saw a Global Times editorial, actually, that was pretty critical of the government for not pulling out Chinese citizens from danger areas. You know, citizens that were working on oil refineries in nearby Mosul, I believe. But also there were reports that essentially the Chinese embassy in Baghdad has been completely sort of non-responsive to Chinese citizens in the country. I think that what this might highlight to Beijing is that it's going to have to start bolstering its economic and financial operations in unstable countries, you know, might be the Middle East, might be Africa, with some sort of security presence, which is a bit of an affront to its principle of non-intervention, obviously, but it's looking to be practical. But I don't think, you know, this sort of criticism is really that widespread as to cause Beijing to really take action in Iraq, but it's, I think it's something worth noting.
Yeah, I think in recent days, there's been a couple of Chinese media articles in the state media, obviously, about the security forces protecting these Chinese. There's like 15,000 Chinese workers, I think, in Iraq. And so there's one article that said like the three levels of security. One was the Iraqi government. The other was private security contractors. And the last were like Chinese special forces that I think are basically protecting the embassy but can be deployed to save citizens. Another article said that the Chinese embassy in Iraq gets weekly notifications from all Chinese enterprises about their specific security situations to help prepare for a possible evacuation. So I think you're right that there's this somewhat criticism of the government in light of what happened in Libya in 2011 about China not doing enough to the Chinese government not doing enough to secure its citizens abroad. And I think you're seeing that with all these articles kind of trying to reassure the Chinese people that, you know, it'll come into their aid if need be.
Yeah. You know, very briefly, I think it's interesting to sort of a contrast the Chinese response with India's response to what's happening in Iraq. So on the strategic level, India is hugely reliant on imported energy. It's home to, you know, 17% of the world's population with only 0.03% of all the oil reserves, and even less when it comes to other sorts of energy. So from Iraq in particular, India imports about 500,000 barrels of oil per day, which isn't a lot, but for a country like India, that still matters for overall supply chains. Apart from that, acutely, 40 Indian citizens were actually kidnapped in Iraq a few weeks ago near Mosul, and they're being held for ransom by ISIS. And the Indian Foreign Ministry has actually been pretty active about this. Both, surprisingly, on social media, they've been constantly updating Indian citizens about the status of these hostages within Iraq. And they've also, taken great pains to get in contact with these prisoners through the International Red Cross, and they're trying to, you know, extract their citizens here. And I think, again, you know, you contrast that with Libya, where India also had a few citizens. And I think it's interesting to kind of see how these two countries have been handling this. Also, you know, there's the issue of illegal Indian workers in Iraq, a lot of whom are kind of stranded now because their employers essentially withholding their passports, which is, I believe, somewhat of a common practice for illegal South Asian workers in the region more broadly. But I think it's something that the Indian Foreign Ministry has again started to take more more of an interest in. When it comes to commenting on the state of the government, though, I think, you know, Modi's government is going to remain particularly silent because India has been very careful about coming down on either side of the Sunni-Shia sectarian conflict, and I don't think it intends to start at this point. Zach, do you see India changing its policy at this juncture? I mean, it has positive relations with both, you know, Iran and several Gulf countries, and it really has no reason to change that now, in my view.
Yeah, well, I would just say that, I mean, the only thing instead I might add, it would be that, you know, keep in mind that India has a huge Shia population, the second biggest outside of Iran. So, I mean, you'd be better able to speak to this, but I don't know how much that influences its position on the conflict. But I mean, I'd be interested. Do you happen by chance know what is Pakistan weighed in on this situation at all, or what are Pakistan's interests in Iraq? Because I mean, it's more Sunni, obviously. So is it like Wayne coming down with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Kuwait in terms of like kind of supporting the Sunnis, or has it not said anything, or do you not know?
I mean, I think maybe even more than India, Pakistan benefits from a bit of strategic ambiguity. I mean, obviously you're right that it is more Sunni and closer to Saudi Arabia when it comes to strategic matters, but it's also Iran's neighbor, effectively. So it can't really afford to alienate Iran at this point, particularly because Pakistan is also reliant on Iran for, you know, economic matters and other issues. So I think that they've been relatively quiet about this, and I don't think they're going to really speak out too much unless they have to. And I think that'll be influenced largely by where events go in the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot for listening. That wraps up this week's podcast on Iraq. And we'll be back next week with more. Thank you.